You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Kick-Ass Politics is sponsored by Fiverr. You've heard me rave about Fiverr before. That's Fiverr with two R's. Fiverr is the world's largest online marketplace for services, with over 100 categories all offered at a fixed base price of just $5. Logo design, business consulting, marketing, business cards and stationery, web design, translation, proofreading, legal consulting, and just about any other service you can imagine, all offered at a fixed base price of just $5. And right now, if you go to kickasspolitics.com and click on the Fiverr ad on our sponsor page, you'll be showing your support for the show, and you'll get some great offers on services tailored to your needs. Whatever you need done, find it on Fiverr. And before we start the show, I want to ask for you, the listeners, help with a special project. Over the next few weeks, we're going to be doing a listener survey to get a better idea of who our audience is. No matter how long you've been a listener or how frequently you listen to the show, we'd like to get to know you better and what you want. So I hope you'll visit our website at kickasspolitics.com and click on the listener survey link on the homepage, or there's a survey link in the show notes to this episode. It'll only take 60 seconds. We won't ask for your personal information or put you on some list. I'm not going to call you up at supper time or fill your email with spam, I promise. In fact, you can even fill out the survey anonymously if you want. It's just a few quick questions to help us understand who's listening, and seriously, it'll be a huge, huge help to me personally. Thanks in advance, folks, and now enjoy the podcast. I'm Mathis, Ben Mathis, and this is Kick-Ass Politics. Just in time for Steven Spielberg's new movie Bridge of Spies this weekend, my guest today is Dr. Vince Houghton, historian and curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. He's also the host of an incredibly interesting and popular podcast called Spycast, which covers everything espionage-related. Today we'll talk about the true story that was the basis for Bridge of Spies, as well as other Cold War espionage stories, America's spy history from the Revolution to the CIA, James Bond, the greatest spy that ever lived, and the coolest spy gadgets he has at the International Spy Museum. All coming up today with my guest, Dr. Vince Houghton, in just a moment.
To Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
Today I'm here with Dr. Vince Houghton. He's the curator of the International Spy Museum and the host of a neat podcast called Spycast. Vince, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Should I have checked you for weapons before you came in here?
Well, you wouldn't have found them if I had any.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's sly. Well, you know, I have to say we're at this event called Politicon in Los Angeles, and I feel like it's an appropriate setting because we have one of the meeting rooms here, and because there was too much noise outside of the doors, I kind of moved the table into the center of the room here. So there's this empty room and then a table. It's totally the perfect setup for an interrogation, I think.
Right. Very. We just need the spotlight and we'd be set up.
Oh, there you go. There you go. And a bucket of water so I can waterboard you.
Doesn't work, by the way.
Which doesn't work. That's what everyone says. Yeah. It really doesn't work.
Yeah, explain. I mean, it gets people to say just about whatever you want them to say to you. I mean, one of the great examples of this is in John McCain's book, talking about Vietnam, where one of his fellow prisoners in the Hanoi Hilton was tortured, including waterboarding, so many times that he finally gave up his chain of command. Unfortunately, it was the offensive line for the Green Bay Packers. He just gave names, whatever the North Vietnamese wanted to hear.
Yeah, and misinformation is just as bad as no information at all.
Perhaps
I'm sure.
worse, right? Because you're expending resources going after things that aren't real.
Yeah.
And so you're sending forces, or you're sending intelligence agencies or satellites or drones to places where it's just a stretch of desert with nothing on it because you've been got bad information from somebody who will tell you whatever you want to hear.
Well, you know, I wanted to have you on the show, Vince, because this weekend the Spielberg film Bridge of Spies is coming out, and you're, among other things, an expert on Cold War espionage. Bridge of Spies is based on a true story. In 1960, the U-2 incident, when a CIA pilot, Francis Gary Powers, was shot down over the Soviet Union during a reconnaissance mission. And the film covers the process and the negotiations of that led up to the prisoner exchange, which took place at the height of the Cold War. First of all, why was this incident significant? I mean, we were spying on them. They were spying on us. Spies disappeared off the face of the planet all the time, I'm sure, and we'll never hear about it. Why was this a seminal moment in Cold War history and in the history of espionage?
Well, we have to take a step back a little bit before 1960 to understand why this was so important. The Cold War was really imbalanced when it came to the ability of countries to spy on one another. The Soviets had a very easy time spying on the United States. We're an open society. We're a democracy. If you want to know where American military bases are, you can drive around the country and say, oh, there's Fort Bragg, there's Fort Benning. If you want to know where American nuclear silos are, you can take a drive through Nebraska or the Dakotas. If you've ever driven along the highway through Nebraska, there'd be the middle of a field, a chain link fence surrounding a concrete slab, and there's a sign on the fence saying trespassers will be shot. Well, that's a Minuteman III silo. You don't need to be James Bond. You just need a car. Can't do that in the Soviet Union. Every time we tried to infiltrate human assets, into the Soviet Union at the beginning of the Cold War, they were rounded up and captured. And a lot of this had to do with the fact that we were so infiltrated at the highest levels of both the CIA and MI6, British intelligence, that they knew about these guys coming in before we did. And so we had a hard time infiltrating human intelligence assets. That meant we had to come up with a new way of doing it. And our new way of doing it was using technology. In some cases, it was using signals intelligence, like what the NSA does. In some cases, it was using imagery intelligence, or IMINT, which is what our satellite program does today, but what spy planes did in the 1960s and later on. I mean, all the way up until the SR-71 was finally retired very recently. The key with the U-2 incident was that we assumed that the U-2 flew so high that it was invulnerable to Soviet anti-aircraft weapons. Huh. We found out the hard way it wasn't. Right? In 1960, Francis Gary Powers and his U-2 was shot down by an SA-2 ground-air missile that no one in the United States knew could fly that high and be that effective against the U-2. So it was a very rude awakening to the technological capabilities of the Soviets. All of a sudden, we realized, oh man, the one advantage we had in technology has been neutralized by the Soviets' ability to shoot down our one chance of looking at the Soviet mainland. As far as diplomacy is concerned, this gave Khrushchev a reason to cancel a summit he was going to have with Eisenhower. And basically, that gets rescheduled with John Kennedy.
Was he looking for a reason at the time?
Yeah, he was looking for a reason at the time to delay this. And because this is, again, in 1960, where there's a presidential election taking place. Mm-hmm. Eisenhower's a lame duck. He's a tough character. Khrushchev is making a calculated decision that Kennedy, if he wins the election, will come in and be much easier to deal with than the former supreme commander of the European theater
of operations.
Someone
he could do business with.
Well, or somebody that he can push around, which was the perception.
Oh, interesting.
Well, at least that's the perception of Kennedy. This is a young guy with no real foreign policy experience. He was an idealist. Khrushchev was a hardcore, been around since the very beginning of the Russian Revolution. You know, this is the guy that's banging his shoe on the on the podium at the United Nations. Eisenhower was somebody that was not going to be pushed around. Kennedy eventually would not be somebody that was pushed around, as the Cuban Missile Crisis demonstrates, but nobody really knew. And so Khrushchev found this as a way to essentially delay the summit meeting until it happens later on. So there's real diplomatic issues, there's intelligence issues, and there's real problems when it comes to the fact that all of a sudden we have a much more difficult time finding out what's happening inside the Soviet Union.
Well, what was Francis Gary Power's mission? What was he looking for on that reconnaissance flight?
Well, there had been significant reconnaissance flights throughout when the U-2 program came into being in the late 1950s. Many of them did not fly over the Soviet Union. Some of them did, obviously. And in this case, they were looking for missile sites. They're looking for bomber bases. They're looking for things that were part of the broader strategic calculus. The idea at the time, the argument at the time, certainly during the 1960 election, was Kennedy beating Richard Nixon over the head with this idea of a missile gap. And before that, a bomber gap. Now, Nixon knew better. And this is one of the interesting political stories of history, is that because Nixon was a vice president, he had access to all
this
intelligence.
Yeah, he would have inside information.
Kennedy didn't. He was just a junior senator from Massachusetts. And so Nixon wanted to say, no, there is no missile gap. We know because we're looking at their missiles. We know that we actually have more than they do. We have a better bomber force than they do. But all this was top secret. And so Richard Nixon, to his credit, could have yelled out in the middle of a presidential debate saying, no, you moron. All right, I know stuff you don't. But he doesn't.
Yeah.
And he loses because of it, right? I mean, this is one of the reasons that brings Nixon down. And so he's in a position where he can't come out and say, no, we know better. And so the real purpose of this was to make up for this imbalance, the idea that the Soviets were very good. They didn't really have to be all that good, but they were good at it, sending spies into the United States and recruiting Americans to give information that was readily available for anybody who had a newspaper subscription and who could drive across the country.
Yeah, and when the plane was shot down, wasn't the cover supposed to be that it was a weather plane?
Sure, yeah.
What was a weather plane, a U.S. weather plane, doing over the Soviet Union?
Well, yeah, we tried to do what we could to support any story, but it was a spy plane. The U-2 was still classified at this point. The problem, of course, is that the U-2 goes down and essentially whole. Right? The wreckage of the U-2, it's not little pieces. It's big chunks of plane and fuselage that you can still see in Moscow today. I've been to the museum in Moscow where you can walk up and essentially touch the wreckage of Francis Gary Power's U-2 plane, because they don't take museum security quite as seriously as we do.
Did the Soviets even know that we had
U-2? Oh, absolutely.
They knew that we had that kind of technology?
The Soviets had been tracking the U-2s since the very beginning of the program.
Okay.
They just couldn't do anything about it. Now, when the SA-2 was developed, all of a sudden they could shoot down the American spy planes. And it wasn't easy. They shot dozens of missiles after Francis Gary Powers. The first one hit. The second one actually shot down a Soviet fighter that was trying to intercept the U-2.
Couldn't
get high enough. Yeah, so they basically were firing indiscriminately in the air, and they got a lucky shot off.
Was this really the first time that something like this had happened, that one of our guys had gotten caught, and it was pretty much public, and the American public knew what was knew all about it?
Really difficult to cover this.
It was a PR thing.
Powers was supposed to start the self-destruct mechanism on the U-2, but he couldn't before he punched out. He got to the point where he had to bail out before he could self-destruct the U-2. He also had a completely optional suicide pin that he carried with him. So a lot of people kind of mess the history up and say Powers was supposed to. He was ordered to kill himself. No, it was optional. If he was shot down over an area that wouldn't treat him well, maybe North Korea, other places, perhaps it would be better
for him to kill himself.
He did not kill himself. He was captured. The plane was captured almost completely. And the United States had no choice but to come out and say, yeah, you know, we kind of screwed this one up. Powers was interrogated harshly. He was tortured.
Oh, he was.
He never broke. He gave them really basic information, but nothing beyond that. Nothing really top secret. They came back when Powers was finally traded back for, which we'll talk about. There was a huge inquiry into, you know, should he be court-martialed? Did he actually give up the family jewels when it comes to the CIA? And many high-level people, including several generals, several members of the CIA at the highest level, determined that he gave them nothing of real value that they didn't know already.
Wow.
And so Powers was awarded several of the highest medals that you can get, including the two highest intelligence medals, the Intelligence Star and the Director's Medal. Basically, that's the Medal of Honor and the Distinguished Service Cross for intelligence because of the fact that he withstood interrogation, he withstood torture, and didn't give away any real important information.
Do you think he would have been executed if we hadn't arranged this exchange?
No. So one of the interesting things about misperceptions about intelligence, in particular through pop culture, is that there's all this killing spies back and forth on both sides. That doesn't tend to happen. It was a gentleman's game from the very beginning. The idea is that if you kill our guys, we're going to kill a bunch of your guys and vice versa. Because everyone understood how important espionage was, it was, you know, it's been key to foreign policy for thousands of years.
It was kind of a little Geneva Convention of espionage between us and the other side.
It's the reason Abel wasn't executed. It's the reason that you don't kill spies that you catch. There's a reason that the Russian 10 weren't executed when we caught them back in 2010. It's the reason that our guys, when they get rounded up overseas, aren't executed. And actually, there are two levels of spies. There's the ones with official cover that actually are attached to an embassy.
Right.
Pretending that you're a State Department official, you're the assistant deputy agricultural attaché or something. And if you are caught spying overseas, if a Russian catches an American who has official cover, you can't even put them in prison. They have diplomatic immunity. The most you can do is kick them out of the country. You ping them.
I want to be one of those kind of spies.
Right. You name them PNG, persona non grata, and then you put them on the next plane out. Now, if they're a NOC, which means they're non-official cover, NOC, they're pretending they're a student or they're a journalist, although we frown upon that.
Those are the spies we see in the movies usually.
Right. Those are the people who are deep undercover, the illegals, as the Soviets called them. They can be given pretty harsh treatment. They can be tortured, interrogated. They can be put in prison, sentenced to many, many years in prison. But in many cases, those are the ones that get traded back. Those are the ones that eventually will get, when we capture some of their guys, we'll come up with a deal like that's shown in this movie, Bridge of Spies, and we'll trade ours for theirs.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that trade. The government brought in a Brooklyn lawyer named James Donovan to negotiate the exchange. Presumably, there might have been sensitive information discussed in these negotiations. Why did the CIA or the U.S. government go outside the government to find someone to lead these negotiations?
Well, they didn't.
Okay.
So I chuckled when I saw the casting for this movie because Tom Hanks is the everyman. He always plays the guy who is like all of us and gets thrust in these extraordinary circumstances. James Donovan was not the everyman. Donovan, during World War II, was counsel for the Office of Scientific Research and Development, the OSRD, which was basically DARPA. It was ahead of all the American science and technological research that was. They were in charge of the atomic bomb program. They were in charge of all the top secret military science and research. Then he was the general counsel for the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which is the predecessor.
Okay, so he was an insider.
He was an insider.
Okay.
He was somebody who knew intelligence. He was somebody that was – he was a lawyer during the Nuremberg trials, right? This is a guy who was all over government. Now, he'd gone to private practice. He was somebody that had left government behind, but he wasn't just some schlub that he pulled off the street. This is somebody that everybody knew. He knew Alan Dulles. He knew some of the top people at the agency.
Okay.
And even later after this, he was the one that negotiated the release of the Bay of Pigs prisoners, those that survived the attack in 1962. So he was somebody that was an obvious choice. He wasn't the first choice because he wasn't involved. He was private practice at the time. But he was somebody that knew the players.
And they could trust him, I assume.
Well, they could trust him. They knew his security clearance was something that was not questionable. And he knew Rudolf Abel, of course, because he had defended Abel, who was the Soviet spy who was traded for Francis Gary Powers.
Interesting. How do you negotiate a spy, a prisoner exchange, you know, when you're dealing in the clandestine services? How do you even start that conversation?
It's all back channel. It's all people that you know from the past. It's all Rudolf Abel's wife was a part of this as well. It was, It was friends of friends and contacts of contacts. You don't want this to be done through official channels. You want to find ways to have conversations, because once you do through official channels, bureaucratic red tape and diplomacy get in the way, very much in the way that we negotiated the Cuban Missile Crisis,
where
we promised to give up our Jupiter missiles in Turkey. They were obsolete anyway, but we couldn't come out publicly and say it.
Yeah.
So we had this back channel.
Nod.
Yeah, a wink and a nod.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, this is how diplomacy gets done. This is how diplomacy still gets done today.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the Iran deal, whether you agree with it or don't, a lot of it was done preparation from years ago with back channel conversations.
Yeah.
A lot of the intelligence cooperation that's taking place in the fight against ISIS today is back channel wink nod between forces that can't publicly work together.
Yeah.
The Israelis and Hezbollah,
right?
Iran and the United States. Yeah, we're having conversations about this because ISIS is kind of the bad guy that brings everybody together. In this case, there was a bad guy. Nuclear war.
Yeah.
Right. Both sides wanted to avoid nuclear war at all costs. And so when you can do something about that, in this case, both the United States and the Soviets realized that this was a way to lessen tensions. This is a way to establish this back channel relationship and it was the solution in this case.
Well, what was the deal that they struck? And talk more about who he was exchanged for on the Soviet side.
Yeah, so Rudolf Abel was a Soviet operations officer. Now, I'm going to use certain terms. We actually don't use the word spy.
Okay.
To talk about people like Rudolf Abel, people that who work for the CIA. The spy is the person that you recruit in the country to give you information. So an agent for the CIA will go over, they're operations officers. They are recruiting spies.
Okay.
So if I go over, if I work for the CIA and I go to Moscow and I recruit somebody within the Soviet Foreign Ministry, they're the spy. I'm the operations officer. So Abel was a case officer. He was an operations officer for the Soviet Union. He wasn't a very good one. He had been brought over at the end of the 1940s, early 1950s, to reestablish the essentially the spies that were spying on the Manhattan Project. He didn't do a great job of it. He didn't have any real spies of note, even when all the to the point when he was arrested in the late 1950s. But he was doing espionage in the United States. He was caught almost by accident. He was rounded up by one of his deputies who had was a bit of a bum. He was an alcoholic. He tried to escape and got caught doing it and then basically ratted out his boss. And this was a time when the FBI actually had some evidence against Abel. Yeah. It was a hollow nickel that had actually been found inadvertently by
a hollow nickel, like a little like a gadget.
Right, exactly. It was a nickel that had been hollowed out by by the Soviet KGB, and inside of it was a special code, and this is a way that they were able to pass information along. Huh. And the nickel had been left and actually picked up by a paper boy. And the paper boy had...
I was going to say, what, did he put it in a vending machine by accident? That would be pretty amateur.
It was left in a dead drop, and it was actually used somehow to... It mixed up with other nickels, and it ended up getting bounced around, and eventually the paper boy dropped it, and it opened up, and all of a sudden the paper was like, this is not a normal nickel. It was handed off to the FBI, but the FBI knew nothing about it. They couldn't break the code that was inside of it. So for a couple years, there was this mystery of the hollow nickel. But when Abel was rounded up, the mystery was solved because he was the one that actually had used that.
Okay.
And so it was used as essentially exhibit number one in his trial against
him. Okay. So we weren't trading for one of their best guys really here.
No, this wasn't James Bond, right? This wasn't somebody who had been running a huge organization in the United States, but it was somebody who was a very public arrest.
Yeah.
The trial itself was very public. Donovan himself in the trial actually says originally he was going to be sentenced to death. And Donovan said, we don't want to do that. He argued against the death penalty, saying, if we put him to death, it'll be very difficult for us to trade for somebody we might need down the road. Right. It goes back to this whole gentleman's agreement that we're not going to kill your guys if you don't kill our guys. Mm-hmm. And Abel really wasn't somebody who was so devious that we needed to do anything other than put him in prison for a long time until the opportunity presented itself to use him as a bargaining chip to get one of our guys back.
Well, you know, you're a historian. Theoretically, what might have been the alternate history of U.S.-Soviet relations if this deal hadn't been reached?
You can't see me shrugging my shoulders on the radio or on the podcast.
Who's to say?
Who's to say? This is counterfactual history, but my shrug on my shoulders is a combination of I don't know and maybe not that much.
Maybe it wouldn't have mattered that much.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure it would have really mattered all that much. I mean,
compared to the Cuban Missile Crisis and the pigs.
Where it matters is in our ability to recruit people. Mm. We want to be able to not only recruit our guys, people to work for CIA and NSA, we also want to recruit spies overseas. And one of the reasons that we really make an effort to get guys back when they've been captured is so that we can say, hey, look, if you get in trouble, we're going to do everything we possibly can to get you back.
Yeah.
Oh, that's one of the issues. The last real big spy trade we made was in December of last year. It was with Cuba. And we traded back the remaining three of the Cuban Five for one of our guys who had been spying for us for many, many years. And he had been in prison for a long time. But it sent a message around the world saying, look, no matter what, we're going to get you out. I don't care how long it takes. We're never going to stop trying.
Yeah.
And that's a really good message to send.
Yeah. That is important. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll talk more with Vince Houghton about the past and the future of the spy trade. Back in just a moment. This portion of the podcast is brought to you by Audible. Audible has over 180,000 audiobooks available to download for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player.
And right now, Kick-Ass Politics listeners can get a free audiobook download and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics or click on the sponsor link on our webpage at kickasspolitics.com and go get your free audiobook. And if you like Kick-Ass Politics and want to help keep us on the air, then please support the show by making a donation to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. Or go to the show website and click on the donate link. Your support will help keep us producing new and interesting programs in the future. That's gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. And now, back to the show. We're back, and I'm talking with Dr. Vince Houghton, host of SpyCast and curator and historian of the International Spy Museum. That kind of sounds like the coolest job in the world, Vince. How did you land that gig?
I didn't mean to. I had really no intention of working in museums. My idea after I got my PhD in intelligence history was to go actually work for an intelligence agency, and I had applied to a bunch, and I had gotten offers from a couple, and I kind of stumbled into this idea of working in museums. And one of the things that really drove me to it is actually the Spy Museum is moving. In about 2 years, we're moving to a new location in Washington.
Oh.
And we're building a new museum from the ground up. And one of the selling points was, hey, Vince, you want to come design a museum? And
I said, wow.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's
absolutely
neat.
So
will there be secret doors?
There will be secret doors and tunnels, and we're getting all sorts of really cool real-world artifacts.
Wow.
That I can't talk about just yet.
Oh, you're such a spy.
But it'll have a little bit to do with the conversation we just had.
Cool.
And there'll be things that I've actually talked about in the conversation I just had. Cool. You know, but
will there be a hollow nickel possibly?
Well, could be stuff like that. but we're really in a position now where we're trying to, our mission is to educate the public. You can't be a citizen in the United States now and not understand how important intelligence is. You see it every single day in the news. You can't open up a paper without seeing something about Snowden or drones or the CIA or the NSA or PRISM or the war on terror and how we're using intelligence to fight it, or Russia and how we're using intelligence, how we're being infiltrated here. And so if we want to have a well-informed citizenry, these are people who are voting for candidates, in a democracy, you have to have a knowledgeable citizenry. And unfortunately, they're not very knowledgeable when it comes to intelligence. And in many cases, it's because of pop culture. Pop culture has led people down a problematic path. And so it's really our job at the Spy Museum. Our number one mission is to educate, is to create a well-informed citizenry that can vote for people, regardless of party, political affiliation, that can make good decisions when it comes to American intelligence.
Yeah, well, I think it's important for people today, especially with everything in the media, and even politicians are kind of knocking the whole intelligence business. I think it's very important for people to understand that this still has value.
There have been a couple times where we've decided that we didn't need intelligence. Right after World War II, where the OSS was disbanded and we had no CIA yet, and realized that very quickly that the Cold War was going to necessitate a permanent peacetime agency. There was also conversations after the end of the Cold War where members of Congress said, do we really need a CIA anymore? Well, 9/11 kind of took that conversation and put it on its head. So the problem is it's a bipartisan stupidity in many cases on the part of members of Congress, on the part of politicians, on the part of the press, where intelligence gets politicized. So if the CIA screws up, it's Obama's fault. If the CIA overreaches, it's George Bush's fault.
Yeah.
If you know Snowden is showing policies that the left is very quick to latch onto and say, Bush overstepped, it's all Bush's fault. But the Obama administration's kept these policies going, and in many cases has increased these policies. Now, there's times when the intelligence community deserves to be held with their feet held to the fire. There are times when they make serious mistakes, where they overreach, where they overstep. And absolutely, the people who are in charge of this, whether it's members of Congress or the FISA courts or the president, needs to step in and say, hold on, right, you've gone too far. Whether it's Watergate or ConIntelPro, when the FBI was spying on the civil rights movement, on the anti-Vietnam movement, the Pike and Church committees, whether it's the torture report. I don't care what politics you have, that report people at CIA were saying, some obviously not publicly, were saying it's about time.
Yeah.
Whether it's the 9/11 Commission, whether it is the overreach of the Patriot Act has been now brought back in many cases. It's the job of the press. It's the job of the American public. It's the job of these oversight agencies, to step in and say, hold on. But the minute partisan politics gets involved, that's when national security is really threatened. And that's true for every side and every single party. This is not something we need to politicize. Like the military, this is something that needs to be beyond politics. And the one positive thing that we've seen is that people who are chosen to serve on HIPC, the House Intelligence Committee, and the SSCI, we used to call it SISI, but they don't like that anymore, tend to operate above politics. And they've gotten that right in most cases. There are outliers here and there. Well, I'm not going to name names, but there are people who are there just because of partisanship. But in many cases, you do see these committees working together, Republicans and Democrats, to make sure the good of the country is taken in the number one consideration.
Well, yeah, and the Americans who go into intelligence, they're just as big a hero as anyone who goes into the military and fights
Absolutely.
For this country. They just don't necessarily get the credit.
Yeah, I mean, they have some of the same problems that the military veterans have. PTSD within the mm-hmm. intelligence community is incredibly high. And, you know, you don't necessarily have the same kind of, look, I'm a veteran myself. Every veteran deserves everything they get. But people within the intelligence community are now more than ever as militarized in many cases as the military is. Yeah. The attack on Tora Bora, where we almost got bin Laden right after 9/11, there were six guys who almost made it to the top of the mountain. Three were military special operations. Three were CIA. Right, the guys who killed bin Laden in the end were SEAL Team 6, but they were actually members of the CIA.
Oh, they were?
They had to be because the United States military is not going to invade an allied country Pakistan.
Interesting.
So they were temporarily chalked over.
Put under the umbrella.
Under CIA. The minute they got back, they were now Navy SEALs again. So since 9/11 more than anything else, you have the militarization of the CIA where they're dealing with a lot of the same issues.
You know, there's been a lot of pushback from the public, from the media, even from some politicians against various surveillance techniques, some of which we've discussed, the data mining, also, you know, drones, et cetera. Do you worry that all this could hamstring our intelligence services from being able to do their job? I mean, isn't this kind of what spies do?
Well, I mean, it does hamstring our intelligence agencies, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We within the intelligence field exist within the gray. There's no black and white. And in some cases, we could be doing exceptional intelligence work, but it would go against everything we are as a country. The Gestapo was very good at what they did, but we don't want the CIA to turn into the Gestapo.
Yeah.
The KGB was exceptional at what they did. The Stasi, very good. There was no one that was going to do anything without the Stasi knowing about it. But do we want the NSA to turn into the Stasi? I would say even the most pro-intelligence, anti-Snowden people say absolutely not.
Does that put us at a disadvantage? Well, particularly when you talk about earlier the Soviet Union, how it was a closed society. Here we had everything in the newspapers and it's America. Are we a little bit behind in this whole game with other countries?
Perhaps. But this is the debate that we've had since the very founding of the country.
Yeah.
This is the idea of a transparent government and a inherently secret institution of intelligence. This is the debate between privacy and security. This is the debate that our founders had. And our founders had it about intelligence, too. Right? All of our founding fathers were intelligence people. At the very beginning, Washington was the great spy master. Franklin was the first real overseas operations officer. Jefferson and Adams were both running counterintelligence operations in the United States. I mean, the John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, was the chief of counterintelligence for the United States during the Revolution. Alexander Hamilton was the big, real first chief of analysis for the revolutionary government. So all these guys were doing this from the very beginning. So this is a conversation that has been happening over and over and over again.
Let's talk about that, because we have, since the days of George Washington and the Revolution, we have had spies in America.
Yep.
We have had espionage. Was it really World War II that we began to have an official intelligence agency in the OSS and then what followed the CIA?
Right.
What kind of spurred that to become an organizational part of the government for once?
Well, I mean, you said it exactly right. It was World War II. I mean, the history of American intelligence ebbs and flows with wars.
Mm-hmm.
So when we were at war, we had a strong intelligence agency, for lack of a better word. During peacetime, that agency essentially disappeared.
Okay.
So at the end of the Revolutionary War, American intelligence stopped existing. for the most part. We had no agencies. Even the military didn't have permanent agencies for intelligence. The big, you know, we're planning in the new museum, and we're talking about how do we fill that time period in American history between the Revolution and the Civil War. And really what it comes down to is Lewis and Clark. Lewis and Clark is a big intelligence operation of that time period. It's, it's what we call a geospatial intelligence operation. It's mapping. But there's not a whole lot of other intelligence happening during that time until you get to the Civil War. A little bit during the War of 1812, but not a lot. In the Civil War, you see it go right back up again, right? The Bureau of Military Intelligence, reconnaissance balloons, a lot of new innovations. Yeah.
But we never had a permanent peacetime intelligence service.
Yeah, and even in, within the military, it's until the 1880s that both the Office of Naval Intelligence and Army Intelligence are formed, right? Okay. So 100 years after the formation of the country. Now, during World War II, the realization after Pearl Harbor, and Pearl Harbor is the impetus for all of this, because we were caught with our pants down at Pearl Harbor, we realized that we needed something permanent. We needed something peacetime. We needed something that would be able to stop the next Pearl Harbor from happening, especially because the next Pearl Harbor would probably be a nuclear Pearl Harbor. Yeah. And with that in mind, the CIA is created in 1947. We went about 9 months without any intelligence agency. The OSS was disbanded at the end of the war. And then the Central Intelligence Group came about in 1946, which turns into the CIA in 1947. But that was the time when we finally said, all right, we can't mess around anymore. We have a existential threat from the Soviet Union. We knew they'd eventually develop atomic bombs. And imagine a Pearl Harbor with atomic weapons. The surprise was not something that we could at that point live with anymore.
Yeah.
And the CIA has become a fundamental part of American government. And now we have 17 intelligence agencies that are permanent within the intelligence community. So there's been a massive expansion in capabilities.
We decided we like this. So.
We decided on several aspects of this. This is good for providing national security. This is good for business.
Yeah.
There's a lot of money involved in this, and it was necessary.
Yeah. Now, can you establish for me once and for all, is it the CIA or is it CIA?
It's CIA.
And
right.
why is it CIA? The people,
it's
the real
question,
spies
right?
say
yeah.
CIA.
And so we say FBI and we say NSA and NRO. I guess the is kind of intrinsic to it. You don't really
is it
need
redundant?
To say. Yeah, it's not.
Okay.
So Central Intelligence Agency is the way the pros say it. And it's kind of a way. It's kind of a way to separate the men from the boys, or the real from the posers.
Okay.
Is the people who say the CIA versus CIA.
So if I want to come off as legit, I say CIA, and I don't call myself a spy.
Right. Yes. If you want to pretend, you say I'm as an operations officer for CIA.
Okay. Which I believe is a federal offense to impersonate.
Although it happens all the time.
Yeah. I'm sure. Usually guys who are cheating on their wives and stuff. I have to go on a mission.
Right.
Well, yeah, then interesting. So in your opinion, who was the best spy who ever lived? Or is it someone that the public may never even know? Is it one of those stars on the wall at Langley?
So more than likely, it's probably somebody we'll never find out about. The greatest spy I know about is, unfortunately, it's a Soviet spy. It's a guy named Dmitry Bystrylyotov, which is the most Russian name ever.
Yeah.
He was a spy for the Soviets back in the 20s and 30s, and he was a Romeo spy.
What is a Romeo spy?
A Romeo spy is somebody that uses seduction.
Oh, that's the kind of spy I want to be, though.
Right. So so Bystrylyotov and all the spies I know about is the closest thing to the real-world James Bond as you'll ever find.
Okay.
He seduced his way through Europe. He had about 20 different personalities that he could snap into, everything from an American gangster to a Hungarian count to a Norwegian fishmonger to a British noble. And depending on the situation, he was able to change accents and languages and personas. The reason I think he's an amazing spy is he is the first person to find out about Germany's plans to rearm, Hitler's rearmament plans, after he, in 1935, he was able to seduce his way into finding out that the Germans had planned on purchasing huge amounts of new weapons and new arms for to become the Nazis that we all know and hate today. After that, he got caught up in Stalin's purges, even though he was a master spy and he wasn't somebody who was a Trotskyite or anything like that, because he had been...
He couldn't seduce himself out of that?
Well, there's a great story there. He came in on the ground floor, and because a lot of the people that came in the 20s were caught up in the purges, he wasn't sentenced to death. He was sent to the gulags, or the idea that he would die in the gulags. Well, 15 years later, he was still alive. He had outlived Stalin. He'd survived the gulags, and in doing so, had used seduction actually in the gulags. He wrote a memoir that we have at the Spy Museum, if you want to come look at it.
Not the most romantic atmosphere.
Well,
for
and people look at the memoir, and it's basically written in like in charcoal and other things like that. But on the cover of the memoir, there are red stripes. It gave a little bit of color. And people ask, like, how in the world did he get red inside the gulag? Yeah. Right, this is a camp that's supposed to work you to death. Well, he had seduced the guards, the women guards, to get their lipstick.
Oh, wow.
To use that. So even when he was in the gulag, he was seducing his way to better treatment. And and the guy actually lived all the way into the 1970s. So as somebody that Stalin tried to kill on many occasions, he outlives Stalin, and then he lives on a long and fruitful life. And he, to me, if you want to personify the real-world James Bond, it's him.
Wow. Well, what are some of the exhibits that you have at the International Spy? I haven't been yet, but it sounds like the coolest museum ever. What are some of the neat things that people can find at the International Spy Museum?
Well, the Spy Museum has the largest exhibit of espionage artifacts on public display anywhere in the world. We have everything. Our most priceless spy, our most priceless artifact, from a historical perspective, is we have a letter that George Washington wrote during the American Revolution to a man named Nathaniel Sackett. Now, Sackett's not somebody that pops up in history books, but Sackett was somebody that was incredibly important for American history. Now, to take a step back, we don't win the American Revolution without good espionage. The British had every advantage. On paper, they should have won the war. They had a battle-tested professional army. We had a bunch of ragtag militias. They had the world's greatest navy. We had a bunch of privateers, which is a euphemism for pirates.
Yeah.
They had the greatest economy in the world. We could barely throw together $2. So we had to outspy them. And it sounds self-serving as somebody from a spy museum saying spying was the key to the war. But when General Cornwallis, was brought before British Parliament after the war and asked, how the hell did you lose this thing? He said, they outspied us. So I've got a good reason to say that. Now, we didn't outspy them at the beginning. We weren't very good. And in fact, the first couple spy operations were disasters. When Washington loses New York City, which actually happens very early in the war, actually only 3 months after the Declaration of Independence, it looks like the war is going to be lost. The British take New York. They're marching to Philadelphia. The Continental Congress is even pulled out of Philadelphia because they fear that they're all going to get captured. Washington writes a letter at the end of 1776 to his cousin saying, I fear we lost this thing. We didn't have any intelligence assets that were worth a damn at the time. We needed to know that it was happening inside New York. And so Washington asked for volunteers, and no one really wanted to volunteer for it was essentially a suicide mission. But there was a young, brave, patriotic man who had just graduated from Yale by the name of Nathan Hale. And Hale's name some people may have heard of. And Hale said, I'll do it. I'll go and I'll volunteer to go into New York City and find out what's going on. The problem was Hale was a terrible spy. Hale was a bad spy for two reasons. One is
he did get caught.
Well, he got caught. And the reason he got caught is what makes him a terrible spy, in that you want to be effective in espionage. You want to be nondescript. You want to be able to blend in. Well, Hale couldn't blend in. He had a huge scar on his face that he got from when a gun backfired on him and exploded. So he was very recognizable. And Hale was a Quaker. And Quakers have one redeeming value in normal world, but is a horrible value to have as a spy, and that Quakers don't lie. And so Hale infiltrated New York. He did a good job of that, and he did a smart thing. He went to a pub on the dock to try to talk to people, because that's where people speak freely, and was recognized. And tried to hold out a little bit by not saying anything, but eventually said, yeah, I'm Nathan Hale.
What do you do? If you're a Quaker spy, what do you just keep trying to change the subject?
It wasn't something that was going to work out very well. So he's arrested, and very quickly he's hanged. And he very famously doesn't say, although pop culture says he did, my only regret is I have one life to give for my country, doesn't say that in real life. That only appears about 30 years later in print.
I didn't know that.
And it's very similar to a poem that was very popular during the time. What we know is he said something very brave. It wasn't that, but he also said something very brave, and then he was hanged. Now, Washington realized at that point that he couldn't keep sending one guy after the next into New York City, amateurs, to get rounded up. He needed to do something to professionalize American intelligence. He didn't know of anybody, the problem. He didn't really know anybody that knew anything about intelligence. But the former head of counterintelligence for New York now was with Washington's camp and said, look, I know this guy. And that usually doesn't start well when you say, I know this guy. But in this case, it did work out. And the guy he knew was a guy named Nathaniel Sackett. And Sackett was somebody that had studied intelligence. He had read a lot of books. He had studied the way the Europeans did intelligence. He understood things like dead drops and secret writing and how to do codes and how to run spy agencies, for lack of a better word. And so Washington wrote a letter to Nathaniel Sackett and said, "Dear Mr. Sackett, I'll pay you $50 a month plus a $500 signing bonus to come be America's first spy master, to organize American intelligence." Sackett agreed to be the first organizer for American intelligence, and the rest is really history. He creates the first professional intelligence organization that turns into the Culper Ring, which finds Benedict Arnold, finds a huge plot to try to destroy the American economy, and helps us win the war. The letter Washington wrote to Sackett is what we have in the museum.
That's awesome.
So for intelligence, for American intelligence, is basically the Magna Carta and Constitution kind of all rolled into one.
That's really cool.
It's a letter. It's not flashy, but historically it's amazing. We actually have the Aston Martin DB5 from Goldfinger.
I was just going to ask if you had one of the cars. Yeah.
We actually have the Jaguar from Die Another Day also, that Jang.
Oh, wow, you've got some really cool stuff.
And we have a mint condition Enigma machine as well, too, at the museum. So
this would make a great man cave.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. It's my workplace is basically the man
cave. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So we talked about the props. Yep. But before we go, the most interesting, the funnest part about the whole spy thing is the gadgets.
Right.
What's the coolest spy gadget that you have in the museum?
Oh, there's so many. There are great assassination gadgets. We have fountain pens developed by the CIA that actually have needles instead of pen points that can be filled with poison.
Wow.
There is the...
I think they have insulin injectors like that now.
Yeah,
don't they?
Well, this is one that's
developed by the CIA.
There's the rectal toolkit, which is
the
least comfortable thing you can possibly have. But these were spies for escape and evasion. It was full of tools that allowed you to break into locks and safes and other things like that. That if you're captured
in your person,
you hit it in your person.
Okay.
Yes. And it's not small either. It's relatively large. You can imagine it's about the size
of dedication to your country.
Yeah, it's about the size of the reading glass cases that you see in like a drugstore. It's not small. I look at it and just kind of tear up a little bit when I see it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really great bugging devices that we have that are hidden in everyday objects.
Yeah.
We have a replica, and it's a replica because the real one is at the bottom of the Atlantic somewhere. We have the replica of the umbrella weapon that was used to kill Russian dissident Georgi Markov. Markov was a Russian dissident that had moved to London, and he thought he was safe in London.
Except, is this the one fairly recently in the past 10 years?
No, this actually was in the 1970s.
Or supposedly Putin had killed?
No, this is in the 1970s where Markov felt he was safe in London and walking in broad daylight across a bridge right outside of Buckingham Palace.
Yeah. And umbrellas blend in London.
Right, exactly. Nice. Everyone's carrying a black umbrella, and this umbrella was designed to fire a ricin pellet. Yeah. Into Markov's leg, and Markov took a couple more steps and dropped dead, and everyone thought he had a heart attack until they did an autopsy and realized he had been killed. The cool thing about our replica, and yes, it's a replica, is what we have is a contract with a guy named Vladimir, and that's all you're going to get from me about Vladimir. But Vladimir is somebody that worked, again, I'll be very coy about that, with the SVR, which is the modern-day equivalent of the KGB.
Oh, okay.
And we have a contract with Russian intelligence to build us our replicas. So the stuff inside the spy museum that is not real, our replicas, aren't built by Bob down the street in Washington.
Yeah.
Russian intelligence, based on their blueprints,
that's awesome.
Of the original stuff is built.
That's
building our stuff. Right. So that's one of the kind of our claim to fame is like, look, you're seeing either the 95% of the artifacts in the museum that are real, but the 5% that aren't.
Yeah.
Are pretty close to real because they're built by many of the same people that built
that's
the original.
Cool. Then do you have to share with them the blueprints for the American ones that you make on the other end?
That's not part of the deal.
Quid pro quo? Okay.
The American technical services guys at CIA don't need extra cash
yeah.
in the same way that the Russian SVR guys do.
Okay. Well, everyone should check out the International Spy Museum next time you're in D.C., and good luck on the new building and the new museum. Can't wait for that. And folks, you can listen to SpyCast on iTunes every week, hosted by Dr. Vince Houghton. Vince, thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's been a blast to be here.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Dr. Vince Houghton for coming on the show. If you're ever in D.C., you've got to go to the International Spy Museum. It's probably the coolest, or at the very least, the funnest museum in Washington, D.C., and it's a perfect change of pace if you need a break from the Smithsonian for an afternoon.
You can go to their website for more information at spymuseum.org. And also, if you enjoyed this episode, subscribe to the museum's weekly podcast hosted by Vince himself. It's called Spycast, and you can find it on iTunes just like Kick-Ass Politics. Be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes and leave us a review. And don't forget to go on our website or click on the survey link in the show notes to take that listener questionnaire for me. I really want to get a feel for who our audience is, and if you just take a minute to fill that out, that'll be a huge help to me. If you like what I'm doing here, then I hope you'll support Kick-Ass Politics by making a donation on the website or go to GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics. Because starting last week, we're now ramping up to 2 podcasts a week, but that also means it's costing twice as much, most of which comes out of my pocket, to be honest, and I'm happy to do the show because I enjoy this, but if you want to pitch in, that's always greatly appreciated and really shows me that you value the effort that I put into this every week. So if you want to help out, you can donate on the website or go to GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, gripes, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. In the next episode, my guest will be Mike Pesca, host of the extremely popular podcast, The Gist, from the folks at Slate Magazine. This guy's hilarious and opinionated as hell, and we'll cover everything from the House Speaker's election to his ongoing war with Starbucks, all over a reduced-fat turkey bacon breakfast sandwich. Coming up in the next podcast. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. This podcast may not be reproduced without express written permission. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.